Well, it's always good for me to be here with the Chamber, because as you mentioned, I was at the Confederation of British Industry for a number of years in the 90s. I have spoken at a large number of Chamber of Commerce events, both in the UK but particularly around the world, and so I always feel quite at home with chambers and particularly enjoy the interaction. Now, what I plan to do today is to really to talk about the kind of situation that the European Union, and particularly the Monetary Union, finds itself in. And I know I'm talking to, as it were, a mixed ability class, because I know there'll be some people who probably know more about this than I do, but others who perhaps may be a bit more distant from the Monetary Union. But in the last few weeks and months, the travails of Europe have, of course, been on the front page, and I dare say on the front page in China as well as everywhere else. And I think that they've become somewhat fashionable around the world, and I certainly noticed this in the US, but I've noticed this in this region, to write Europe off, you know, that it's kind of all over, and it's not going to work, that the Monetary Union's weaknesses have been exposed by the crisis, and Europe is condemned to insignificance and to irrelevance in the global economic picture. I'm hoping to persuade you today that that's broadly speaking correct, and it's all over for us. No, sorry. What I'm going to try and do is to offer a slightly nuanced view. You know, I don't think there's any point in concealing the fact that Europe faces some pretty big challenges in the next 3 or 4 years. But nonetheless, there are recently some signs that the problems are being grappled with, and that maybe we can get through this difficulty and remain economically significant and economically strong. So that's my aim there this afternoon. Now, just to look quickly at where we are, well, you know, there's 27 countries. Overseas, people often seem to forget that the Union has been on an expansionary track, and indeed, of course, is still likely to expand further. In spite of all the problems, you know, the queue of potential applicants remains quite robust, with Croatia almost certainly the next, and then with, of course, the Turks in the wings. And as I was just talking about before lunch, David Cameron has gone to Turkey yesterday and made a rather firm speech about his support, the British government's support for Turkish membership. And if you look at the Monetary Union, well, those are the countries that have got the euro for the moment, and there are others. In fact, actually, this is not completely true, because Montenegro, although it's not formally part of the Monetary Union, actually uses the euro, and Estonia will be the next member. So even though the Monetary Union, as I say, is widely written off, particularly by economists in the United States, in fact, there are still applicants, and the likelihood is that the breadth of the Eurozone is likely to continue to grow. And, of course, also, if you look at GDP per head, and the EU figure has gone down somewhat because of enlargement, taking on some countries with lower GDP per head, you know, we remain a wealthy region, and that shouldn't be forgotten. And in fact, in terms of the overall size of the economy, the EU economy is actually somewhat larger than the US. Again, something which in places like China or in India, people typically don't think about. They don't think that the overall size of the economy is larger. But this is not all good news, because it looks pretty likely that the post-crisis growth rates in Europe are slow. These are the IMF forecasts. Now, the one thing we know about these is that they'll be wrong. I mean, it's almost inconceivable that there will be sort of straight line growth at around 2%. But nonetheless, if you look at the performance recently, it's likely that EU growth will be lower. In fact, over the last decade, over the first decade of the Eurozone, another relatively little-known fact, certainly overseas, is that GDP growth per capita has been in the last decade identical in the US and in the Eurozone at about 1.5% a year. And often people simply ignore the fact that US population growth has been more rapid. So on a per capita basis, the Eurozone has grown at exactly the same rate as the US for a decade. But at the moment, the expectations are that European growth rates will be lower. And the real reason for that, the strongest reason for it, is the large debt overhang in Europe, particularly, of course, the sovereign debt overhang, but not just that. There's household debt in some countries, particularly in the UK and France and Spain, which is likely to constrain growth, in that there is a likelihood of a deleveraging process that needs to be gone through, most dramatically, of course, in places like Greece. And it's certainly also true that the world's centre of economic gravity is moving east. This is one of these clichés that people use. And some rather pedantic French economists, actually, working at HEC in Paris, have tried to say, where is it, the world's economic centre of gravity? Which is a rather amusing sort of calculation. The idea is to say, which is the point on the world's surface which is closest, on average, to the major centres of economic activity. And you can see that in the mid-70s, the world centre of economic activity was in Iceland. Well, it isn't now, for a variety of reasons. Of course, and it's kind of logical, which was that the two big centres were North America and Western Europe, and then there was a kind of pull to the north, essentially exerted by Japan in the mid-70s. So it was halfway between the US and Western Europe, but pulled slightly north by Japan. But the growth, and particularly in the Chinese coastal cities, has pulled it as far as 2004, when the last time they did these calculations, where it was close to Spitsbergen. And in fact, the more recent calculations, which I haven't been able to put on this map yet, show that it's actually careering off down into Siberia and is now somewhere near Krasnoyarsk, which is now the distinctive centre of the world's economy. That is because the huge growth in China and India is sort of pulling this centre. And it seems to me that this, is something which is happening and there's not much you can or should want to do about it. If you look back 150 years, the world's centre of economic gravity probably was there again, and it's shifted way back to the west. And so, my philosophy about this is, well, if a thing is inevitable, you might as well welcome it. Or, in other words, you might as well embrace it and do something about it. And certainly from the LSE point of view, that's what we do. And we adjust our business so that we are attractive to people from this part of the world. So undoubtedly this is happening, and there's no point in pretending that it's not. But of course, you, who are all Europeans, or largely based in China, that's why you're here, because this is happening. But it's also true that Europe's weight in world affairs is declining. I mean, this is an extremely simple way of looking at it, but in the crisis, the big jump from the G7/G8 in terms of global economic management to the G20 has significantly reduced Europe's weight in these global bodies. That seems to me to argue quite strongly for seeking a unified European voice in these bodies. This is not a popular point of view in the United Kingdom, I have to say. But it does seem to me that if you are now representing only a sort of quarter of the votes in the key body, that if you want to be influential, you'd probably do well to ensure that those voices were saying the same thing. At the moment, of course, we don't seem to be getting very close to that, and the notion of a sort of single European seat in these bodies is not yet widely accepted. But it is undoubtedly true, and there's no hiding it, that the European dominance, sort of numerically anyway, in these global bodies has gone, and it went very suddenly. You know, the G7 has been the key body for a long time, and then all of a sudden in the crisis, bang, we went to the G20, which is creating you know, quite a grinding of gears in Europe, I think, as to how you adjust to that and how you make yourself nonetheless effective at projecting your points of view. Unfortunately, you know, the outcome of the last Lisbon Treaty produced these three leaders. I'm nothing against these three individuals, but it's not quite, I think, what people thought would be the outcome in terms of people who would project Europe overseas. When I've put this slide up in one or two parts of the world, I don't get a huge number of responses unless it's the European Chamber as to knowing who these people are. And I got kind of nil response in India when I put these three up at the Indian Council of Foreign Relations, and they just hadn't a clue. And I think this is a significant problem, and I don't think there's any hiding from it, actually, that the outcome of that constitution and the Lisbon process, which was meant to produce, you know, a sort of clearer set of leaders for Europe, has not delivered quite what people had in mind. But to get to the problem, this is the problem. We all know that the real issue in Europe recently has been the pigs. Of course, you get told off if you use pigs in Europe, but roughly it is, of course, the problem that has emerged in the last year, particularly, of highly indebted countries on the periphery, if you like, of the Eurozone economy, and what to do about them, with Greece, of course, being the most difficult issue of all. Now, what we saw is, of course, that the market suddenly, having for a long time, right from the beginning of the Eurozone, regarded the debt of all Eurozone economies as broadly equivalent. I mean, this shows the spread of 10-year Greek government bonds over German bunds. And, you know, there was a spread. There's always been some spread in the monetary union, with the German bund being the kind of benchmark rate and everybody else situated slightly above it. But as you can see, right up until middle of 2008, this spread was tiny, and at some points it practically was non-existent. And it was clear that, you know, for this long period, the market thought that lending to the Greeks was essentially the same as lending to the Germans. And I vividly remember in middle of 2008 talking to an investment banker who, and the Greeks had just got a big bond issue away. And I said, well, you know, given all these worries emerging, I said, you know, how did you do this? He said, well, it's easy. He said, I was just, you know, selling German bunds at 3 percentage points over. He said, that's a piece of cake. And that was the way the thing was sold. You know, that these were essentially, these were Eurozone bonds. Nothing could happen in the Eurozone. They would essentially be discounted at the ECB at the same rate. What could go wrong? But then gradually, through 2008, and then rather suddenly at the end of 2008, people suddenly said, help. When they started to look at the small print, they discovered that actually there was no guarantee of Greek bonds by anybody else. There was no guarantee by the ECB, there was no guarantee by the European Commission, and there certainly was no guarantee by the German Treasury of these bonds. And so clearly, that what happened then was a massive spread opened up, and it hasn't disappeared. The market remains of the view that Greek bonds are significantly riskier than others. Now, why did this happen? Well, you know, many people focus on the fiscal dimension of this problem. But in my view, the real problem is the underlying problem is a divergence in competitiveness. And it's quite striking that the competitiveness of different economies has diverged. And this only just shows the last 4 or 5 years, but quite a sizable gap just in that period between the Greeks' unit labour costs, so this is the yellow line, and the Germans. And in fact, if you look over a slightly longer period, I mean, since the Eurozone, this is what you see. And I'll spend a moment on this chart because it's kind of the centre of my argument. What this shows, it's a slightly complicated chart, but rather an interesting one, I think, is across the horizontal axis, it shows export growth related to the European average over this decade. And on the vertical axis, it shows the change essentially in unit labour costs over that period. So if you were at the centre of this graph, and nobody is quite at the centre, then your export growth would have been exactly the European average, and your unit labour cost growth would have been exactly at the European average. If you're in the bottom right-hand corner, which is where the Germans are, your export growth has been significantly, has been 33%, I think, it's about a third more than the average for the EU, and your unit labour costs have gone down by 16% relative to the European average. I mean, this is a stunning performance by the German economy over that decade. You know, the Germans, who arguably joined the monetary union at an inflated exchange rate, you know, many people said at the time the French had done a great deal by locking the Germans in at too high a rate for the Deutschmark. The Germans have then pulled their sleeves up and got on with it and have had very low wage growth, have had union deals which have kept wage growth below inflation for a number of years, and productivity has risen, and as a result they've seen the benefit in the form of significantly better export performance. So have the Austrians, who are sort of in the same bottom right-hand corner as well. The Finns, you know, labour costs have gone up by about the average, but they've done pretty well. And Ireland, a rather odd position, where they had a big catch-up because wage rates were very low in Ireland, and a lot of inward investment, which produced a better export performance, even though their labour costs were rising rapidly. But the big problem is, of course, the top left-hand corner. People like, the French unit labour cost performance hasn't been great. Their export performance has been even worse. But the problem you can see is Greece, Portugal, Italy, and Spain. And this is in a way, why these countries have got sort of doubts expressed about them. Their unit labour costs have been rising more rapidly than the European average, and their exports have been also rising less rapidly than the European average. And this is therefore, in my view, the underlying problem is a competitiveness problem. And it does seem as though these countries have been increasing their prices or not increasing productivity. It's no doubt a combination of the two, in a way that has left them fundamentally uncompetitive. Now, of course, you've got to map against that the budgetary issue, because clearly this is bad and is likely to leave you, with living standards not rising as rapidly as the German living standards if you persist in this kind of performance. But it obviously goes critical if you also have very high national debt. And so that's why the Greeks are in a particular problem, and this is the only other sort of complicated chart that I plan to show you. And what this shows is across the horizontal axis is the cumulative budget deficit in these 2 years, 09-11. That's the sort of 09-10 and 010-11, and we pretty much know what those deficits will be. This shows you that, you know, the Greeks, and actually it shows you the UK on this is the worst, because the worst is the bigger deficits go to the left. I don't quite know why the chart was, this is a Morgan Stanley chart, quite why it was drawn that way. I'd have drawn it the other way around, but so the worst position is on the left. So the UK is proudly in the position where it has the largest deficit over these 2 years, but as you can see also Ireland and Spain, Portugal, France and the US have been put on there as well to show that, you know, this is not just a European phenomenon, this large debt at the moment. But of course, on the vertical axis, it's debt to GDP. So this, the horizontal one is a measure of the flow, the new debt, and the vertical axis is a measure of the stock, the old debt. And on that, you can see why people particularly focus on Greece, because they've got a big flow of debt, not as big actually as the US or the UK. Their two deficits in these 2 years are not expected to be as big in percentage of GDP, but it's on top of a huge stock of debt already, which of course was revealed to be much bigger than the Greeks had previously acknowledged. And that's why they are in a pickle, because it looks as if, even though they do the aggressive things that they're doing at the moment, that they will end up with, you know, by the end of next year, government debt still of 150% of GDP. And if you're in that position, it's pretty hard work to get yourself out of it, actually, because particularly if the interest rates on your debt are very high, and particularly also if you've got short maturities of debt, so you have to roll a lot over, and that's the position in Greece. I mean, one reason why the position is not so critical in the UK is that we do have long debt maturities. I mean, the average maturity of UK government debt is about 10 years, which is all linked, in fact, with our pension system and our life insurance system. You know, that we've got these long-term savings funds in the private sector, whereas in much of Europe, it's in the quasi-public sector. And they have had an appetite for long-term government bonds, which the government has been, of course, happy to meet. So we typically issue a lot of 20-year gilts, 30-year gilts, and there's a big stock of them. So each year, you're only rolling over. If your debt is, if your average maturity is 10 years, you're only rolling over 10% of your outstanding debt each year. If your average maturity is between 2 and 3 years, which is in the case for Greece, you know, you're rolling over 40% of your debt every year. So you've got to get new money in, representing 40% of your outstanding debt plus your new debt. I mean, this is, you know, why the markets are extremely nervous. There's just too much Greek debt coming onto the market. So there is really a serious problem with Greece, and many people can't quite see how they're going to get out of it. And I would personally say that there's got to be at least a 50-50 chance that Greece will have to restructure its debt at the very least, you know, lengthen out its maturities, etc. But it seems to me from this analysis that there is a perfectly strong intellectual case for saying that these pigs are not all equal, and that there is a very clear distinction between the Greek problem, and Greece is, you know, 2.5% of the GDP of the Eurozone only, and the others. Now, the market doesn't want to hear that at the moment. You know, the contagion has spread over to Portugal, to Spain and to Italy. But it does seem to me that there is a very respectable argument for saying, let's not minimise the Greek issue, which is a very, very difficult one, but let's also not accept the argument that actually it's just, you know, the others are really just the same. They're just kind of Greece in a year or two's time. I don't believe that. It may have been true in the famous joke in England, what's the difference between Iceland and Ireland, is, you know, one letter and one year. But that's probably also not quite true either, since the Irish are grappling with their problem quite effectively. So it seems to me the Greece problem is sui generis. Now, what has been happening? Because clearly these problems are known about. What is going on in Europe, and is it going to be enough? Well, first of all, there's clearly fiscal consolidation going on in a pretty dramatic way in places like Greece and Ireland. It's painful. And of course, there are riots in the streets. But, you know, what we hear from Greece is actually it's happening. They may, you know, there may be some street demonstrations, but actually they are cutting the deficit. In fact, it has been coming down. The European Central Bank has been buying sovereign debt, and particularly buying Greek bonds. This has not been without controversy. The head of the Bundesbank clearly voted against that, but they are doing. And so there is currently a buyer for Greek sovereign debt. Is that really a stable long-term position? I think probably not. It doesn't seem to me to be ideal that it should be the central bank of Europe that is, you know, holding this position. The better answer is that the EU has set up this European Financial Stability Facility, which is headed now by Klaus Regling, who's actually in China this week explaining this to the Chinese. In fact, I attended a lunch with him yesterday. Where he spoke about it. And, you know, that is a facility which has access to guaranteed funds of 440 billion euros, which can step in to provide funds to a European country in trouble. Clearly, the objective is that it shouldn't have to do so, and that only that the fact of its existence ought to stabilise the markets. But if it is necessary, then there is now a facility to step in. Of course, the Greeks had to use the Commission and the IMF before the EFSF was set up. So there was a package provided by the Greeks in a slightly different form. But now, you know, supposing there were a problem for Portugal or Spain, there is a facility where these funds are guaranteed collectively by the 16 finance ministers of the Eurozone to provide funds to countries who can no longer borrow on the open market. So there is now a backstop in place, run by an extremely sensible and very authoritative fellow, Regling, which is where the front office is managed by the German Debt Office, and the back office is managed by the European Investment Bank. So, you know, there is a backstop in place. There have been bank stress tests because the market initially worried directly about the viability of these countries borrowing a lot, then began to worry indirectly about who was holding all this debt. And of course, the people who are holding a lot of it are European banks. And that's really why there was this stress test exercise, which was published, the results of which were published by the Committee of European Banking Supervisors in London on Friday, which was designed to designed to settle nerves in the markets by revealing the capital position of banks, and hopefully by revealing that most of them were okay. I don't personally think that this has been a hugely successful exercise, because the amount of clarity that has been brought to the debate as a result of it is probably not sufficient. I mean, the simple point is that, for example, the banks were required to take a discount on debt they held in their trading books. So if you held a Greek bond in your trading books, you had to take 23% off it and say, you know, would you be okay if that was only worth 77% of what you paid for it? But if you hold it in the banking book and you say, well, I'm holding it to maturity, you didn't have to do that, which is a somewhat artificial point, particularly if you think there's a reasonable chance that Greece would actually have to restructure in the end anyway. So in fact, Citigroup overnight have done some calculations and produced a different number from the one produced last Friday of the amount of capital that banks would need if they actually wrote down the bonds they had in their banking book, and that produces you a whole extra list of banks who would not meet the stress test, and that's swirling around in the cyberspace in the last few hours. So, you know, in my view, that's probably not ended the fuss about European banks, and I think that, you know, there will be a need for more recapitalization of a number of European banks, especially the Spanish savings banks, but also some of the German Landesbanks, also some of the Greek banks, and in fact one or two of the Italian banks, according to this latest assessment by Citigroup. And I pay some attention to that because the guy who did it is a guy called Willem Bouter, who was until 3 months ago a professor at the LSE, so he's quite good on this kind of stuff. And of course, the European Union has put in place a new regulatory system following the De La Rosière report, which has set up a new European Systemic Risk Council, chaired by the President of the ECB, and three new authorities on a pan-European basis, which are designed to try to strengthen the confidence in the regulation of the European financial sector. I don't think I'll go into the detail of that given the time. So finally, the question really is this enough? And the arguments really for saying that it isn't quite enough are that, first of all, the prospect for the southern European countries is not really improving much at the moment. You know, European growth overall is pretty soft, and particularly the fact that the Germans have decided to reduce their budget deficit quite significantly, when arguably there wasn't a strong case for them having to do so, has made life tougher, because it's likely to, you know, reduce market opportunities and reduce tourism and things for these southern European countries. We also still do not have what the French keep saying, an economic government. You know, that the decision making, I mean, even those who defend the position we've now reached, as Klaus Regling did at, in a persuasive speech yesterday, would have to accept that the route we have taken to get to this position has been a shambles. I mean, you know, let's be clear, the decision making has been terrible. It was, you know, nobody knew who was really in charge of making decisions. There were these weekend meetings which only took place when the markets got to a crisis point. It's been a terrible mess. And I think, personally, the French have got a strong argument for saying that you need some kind of more established counterweight to the ECB among finance ministries, and more effective decision-making body than we currently have. That Europe's crisis management mechanisms have simply not been up to the task that was given to them. And lastly, of course, there is no fiscal transfer mechanism within the European Union. Now, economists, of course, attach a lot of importance to this and say you can't really have a monetary union unless you have some kind of mechanism for fiscal transfers to take account of asymmetric shocks. And if you like, that's what we've had. The financial crisis was an asymmetric shock in that it particularly affected countries that had high indebtedness and poor competitiveness. Well, you may argue it's their own fault, but there you go, it's a fine thing to say, but that was the position we were in. And these countries were worse affected, and there is an argument for saying, you know, that you could help them if there were some budgetary mechanism in Europe to allow them to manage their way through, and particularly to finance the kind of reform process they need in order to improve their competitiveness. So this is why I think things have not settled down as much as they might have done, and that's why at the moment what has been done is, I think, by many people not regarded as fully adequate. And the question is whether the pigs will become bacon before these problems are resolved. I mean, finally, it seems to me that there are three kind of options ahead, or three possible scenarios that could develop from here. The first scenario is that political consensus is built around the reforms needed, sort of this kind. You know, that you do build political consensus around the idea that we need a stronger economic government in the Eurozone, and you need some kind of fiscal transfer mechanism to cope with the asymmetric shocks. You know, that's option one. At the moment, the politics look against it because it would require a treaty change, and the appetite among politicians for another treaty is, let's say, low, given the difficulties they had getting the last one through. But, you know, that many people would argue that that is really the logical outcome of this experience, that you have to strengthen the Eurozone further in order to make it more robust. A second possibility is that the whole thing goes foot and that the Eurozone breaks up, either with one or two countries like Greece being forced out at the bottom, if you like, or with one or two countries like Germany pushed out at the top. Of course, it would be easier for Germany to leave the Eurozone than for Greece, because Germany would not have a problem with its debt and probably its currency would go up. I spoke at a conference in Munich a month or so ago, and I have to say, among the people in the Munich financial sector, it was quite clear from all the questions, you know, if I'd asked them whether they thought the Germans should leave the Eurozone, I think they'd have been 80% in favour. You know, they let's not hide from the fact that public opinion in Germany is very, very hostile to what they see as having to bail out people who've been living high on the hog and paying themselves more than they earned, and why should the Germans have to bail them out? So there's a big political problem in Germany for anything which smacks of a bailout funded by the German taxpayer. So the option two is that it breaks up, and option three is that we muddle through. And I suppose the probabilities are that option three will win. It usually does in Europe. But muddling through, you know, is not going to be easy, and will certainly involve quite a lot of implementation of things that people don't really want to do. You know, I think muddling through is likely to mean a combination of probably triggering this European Financial Stability Facility at some point to try to help some countries who would otherwise find it prohibitively expensive to borrow. I think it'll probably involve a debt restructuring for Greece, because I just can't quite see, given what the arithmetic I showed you before, that they will get out of it. I think it will involve the European Central Bank having to hold its nose and do things for longer than it really wanted to do, and intervene and buy in things which it doesn't really want to buy. You know, so muddling through is not a particularly easy route to take, but probably is what's going to happen. I would ascribe quite a low probability to the Eurozone breakup. I don't think it's nil, but I think it's quite low. I would at the moment, sadly, attribute a rather low probability to a genuine attempt to restructure and rebase the Eurozone with a new treaty. I think that's a low probability event as well. So I think we're in this central sort of muddling through territory, but that's going to require quite a bit of effort. Just sort of sitting there and saying, well, we've solved it, I don't think it's going to do. You know, I think governments are going to have to recapitalize their banks. I think the Greeks, as I've said, will have to restructure. I think the Financial Stability Facility will almost certainly be brought into use. I think it will have to be made permanent, this idea that it's a three-year facility which will, you know, run out, I don't think is possible. I think there will be some kind of European Monetary Fund have to be set up. You know, so muddling through is not nothing. Muddling through is not just kind of, let's hope it all stops. It's quite a few things that will have to be built into the process. But, you know, I think it will be done. And I think that it is possible to learn these lessons and to rehabilitate the Eurozone, and that the EU is not quite yet the lost continent. Thanks.